In many parts of the West, the year is divided five ways: winter, spring, summer, fall, and the fire season. The fires can come as soon as the snow melts, and they don't end until it falls again. For 15 summers, Stephen Pine was a firefighter on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. In his new book, Fire on the Rim, A Firefighter's Season at the Grand Canyon, Pine writes that the firefighters' lives were contoured by the geography of the rim and by the rhythms of the fires. Pine is an ecological historian whose books form what he calls a cultural history of wildfires in America. Pine has also written about Antarctica. In the preface to his new book about fighting fires on the north rim of the Grand Canyon, Stephen Pine writes, "This is the story of that place, those times, and the fires, those marvelous fires, that made it all possible."
Fire is really your life. And the longer you stay there, the more it becomes your life, the whole tempo of your summer, your existence. I mean, it's organized by fire, by the capriciousness of fire, by the excitement of fire. And in a sense, you know, since then, my life has been increasingly organized by sort of intellectual concerns about fire and what it means and what its history has been.
You do find fires very beautiful in their own way.
In a way, although I can't claim, I mean, I will claim to be a kind of pyromantic, but I can't claim to have any sort of mystical sense about fire or any special beauty. It, you know, we were doing a job, and there's an excitement to it. There's a kind of beauty in the sound and the action, the drama, the scenery, all those kinds of things. But the sense of somehow staring mystically into the flame and being enchanted by it was really not true. We had a much more vigorous kind of relationship. We're out there slapping dirt on it and squirting water and cutting down burning trees, and it's that kind of sense of fire as interesting and vital.
What are some of the strategies that you've used for containing a fire?
Well, it's a remarkable thing that people can intervene with a kind of natural process in this way. I mean, we can't do it with hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes and so forth, but fire we can within limits, and there are really two things you can do. You can attack the fuels that the fire feeds on, or you can alter the ignition patterns. We can't stop lightning, but you can attack the fire very shortly after it begins, when it's confined to maybe a single tree. Maybe the ground is still wet from the rain, unless it was a dry lightning storm. And at that point, the fire is kind of vulnerable. It hasn't built up so much heat that it can overcome your efforts. If it gets larger, however, you've got to remove the fuels that are around it in some way. We can't stop the wind. We can't change the whole topography, all these other things that influence fire behavior. But we can try to cool it down, and primarily you can try to remove fuel so that it simply runs out of energy. And you do this by literally clearing it out around the fire, as the saying goes, down to mineral soil, down to the non-combustible parts of the earth. And, you know, it's very laborious. It's very time-consuming. If the fire is very large, there's no way that you can build a fire line faster than the fire is burning. So you have to pull back from the fire quite a way, try to anticipate where it will be, put in a line or use natural barriers of one kind, the line, and then burn out the fuels that are between that barrier and the approaching fire.
Would you describe how it smells, how it sounds when you're fighting a fire, and how intense the heat is?
Well, it varies. Everybody, I mean, most of the American public now has been immersed in scenes from Yellowstone, and you know, that is probably the upper spectrum of a forest fire. I mean, barring the day of judgment, nobody's going to see fires that intense, and certainly we weren't encountering fires of that vigor. There's simply nothing you can do with a hand crew, or even with, you know, limited pumps and the rest. So our fires, the whole point was to get there early enough that they were lower intensity fires. And so it tends to be mixed. Parts of the fire are very active, and you would do what we call hot spotting. You would try to attack those fires and quiet them down, and then build a line. But so there's a certain amount of noise from the fire. When it builds up, when it really starts going through the canopy, there's a tremendous kind of whooshing sound. And when you start adding that up through scores or hundreds of trees, there's a tremendous roar associated with it, a giant windstorm. And it is kind of deafening, but it also sort of closes off the outside world, my experience has been, and it sort of drives you in and you start thinking more to yourself. I find myself becoming much more focused, less sort of free-ranging in my experiences and thought, but very intense and doing very well what I'm supposed to be doing under those experiences.
Have you had any close calls in your years of fighting fires?
Well, I probably shouldn't say this, but I never really considered firefighting terribly dangerous in the sense. I think it's something that you learn to do, and you learn where to intervene and where not, what's risky and what really isn't. The usual hazards of firefighting are more injuries than fatalities, and most of the big problems are associated with traffic accidents, aircraft accidents, things like that. I think the biggest hazard is probably falling trees. We're always having to cut trees down that are burning. Usually they're dead. It's not what OSHA would prefer you to do. We do a lot of our work at night, because we find these fires late in the afternoon or early evening, and nighttime's a good time to work on the fire because it quiets down. So there are hazards associated with that. What I would consider minor hazards. I got hit once by a widowmaker, as it was called, a large branch that was burning up in a tree while I was cutting it, and knocked me to the ground, hard hat. Save my hard head. Chainsaw caught fire, and we had a crew of Navajos with us out on this, and they thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever seen. And I'm sort of running out of rolling over the ash and running out, ripping off my fire shirt because embers and stuff had gotten under my collar, and it was really burning my backside, and screaming for someone to get some water on me. And they were so busy laughing and rolling on the ground that they couldn't do anything. But there's a lot of that kind of gallows humor that goes on, too.
What was so funny about that?
Well, they just thought it was hilarious that these guys were out here, they were going to cut this tree down, and they got clobbered. It's
They thought it was a foolish way of fighting the fire?
Well, not necessarily. It's just that things don't go the way they're supposed to. And, they considered that humorous. And I guess I don't necessarily disagree with it. Nobody was seriously hurt. I guess I always thought of it as funny, and I guess now that you mention it, a lot of things that I think were kind of funny were, in fact, fairly risky.
You've written about fire. You've also written about Antarctica and your travels there, and I'm sure I'm not the first one to make the connection to the Robert Frost poem Fire and Ice,
sure,
about which way the world is going to end. It's kind of interesting to me that you've looked at fire and ice.
That's
like
right.
That
that just happened. My academic training was really in cultural history. I was interested in the history of science, history of exploration, and had done work in the 19th century in the American West. And I learned about a fellowship the National Endowment had trying to encourage people to study Antarctica. And I saw this as a way of carrying the story into the 20th century. It required that you spend 1 to 3 months with the U.S. program in Antarctica. And I thought, well, that was interesting. That's a great way to get down there. And I spent 3 months. And it turned out that what I thought the story was not the story at all, that what Antarctica is ice, and more ice, and yet more ice. You've got to deal with that great, vast, icy interior to really understand it. So it was kind of an accident. But comparing fire and ice, I think the difference, is really between the biotic and the abiotic. Ice comes regardless of whether life is there. It can come on lakes and oceans, continents, rocks. It doesn't matter. And if you have more and more ice, it will eventually obliterate life there. But fire is absolutely dependent on life. I mean, it's an expression of life. Marine life gave us an oxygenated atmosphere, and terrestrial life gave us fuels. And fire and life have co-evolved, and you can't have fire without organic debris, living or dead. And so fire is much more vital and sensitive and subtle and varied, and just, if you will, more tied to life. And I think in that regard, much more interesting.
Stephen Pine is the author of Fire on the Rim, A Firefighter's Season at the Grand Canyon.